this is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, the Executive Secretary of the Friends Committee on National Legislation, Diane Randall, speaks in Kalamazoo this weekend. We'll hear from the voice for Quaker advocacy. But first, in its editorial about what it called realities for post-election Michigan, the Detroit Free Press included that electing state Supreme Court justices is ridiculous. The Free Press said that the vast majority of voters went to the polls having no idea who the candidates were, and even candidates who benefited from TV advertising bankrolled by anonymous third-party donors acknowledged that the ads' claims were fraudulent. We're going to take a look at how Michigan ended up with its rather unique system of electing state Supreme Court justices with Western Michigan University political science professor Mark Hurwitz. He has researched how judges are elected and appointed, and Mark Hurwitz co-authored a paper published last year on the history of Michigan's process for selecting state Supreme Court justices. Mark Hurwitz, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Gordon. Pleasure to be here.
Let's begin with a big, broad view here of state Supreme Court justices across the country. What are the various ways that those justices can end up on the bench?
So in the states, the various states can choose whatever kind of selection method they want. They can follow the appointment system of the federal government, and there are some that do that, usually some of the states in the Northeast that were some, you know, the original colonies that became states.
And that would be the governor appoints, and perhaps there's an advise and consent role for the legislature,
exactly.
The U.S. Senate
has? Exactly. So usually the governor will appoint and the state Senate will confirm, and so there are some states that do that. Some states even have the legislature appoint them. Only a couple of states do that. Very popular methods as well are elections. The elections can be either nonpartisan or partisan. Partisan means that when you see Judge Smith go against Judge Jones, it says that Judge Smith is a Republican and Judge Jones is a Democrat. Okay, so that's a partisan election. A nonpartisan election, by contrast, says that Judge Smith is running against Judge Jones, but you have no idea whether or not they're a Democrat or Republican because the party labels are not attached. So those are the two types of elections. Then there's this other system, which is generally run by, it's called a nomination by commission system. Supporters call it the merit system because they believe it takes politics out of the system. Others will call it the Missouri plan because Missouri was the first state to adopt this officially. But it's basically where you get a commission, usually a nonpartisan or a bipartisan commission made up of people appointed by the governor and others. And they'll come up with a list of names, usually three names, and give that list to the governor. And then the governor chooses one of them for a position on the state Supreme Court. So in other words, the governor cannot pick just anyone. They have to pick someone from this list. And then sometime later, somewhere between 6 months and 2 years usually, they'll have a retention election. It's not a competitive election. It's simply an election where the voters are given the opportunity to say, should we retain Judge Smith on the bench? So those are the five main ways of doing it. Two types of appointments by the governor or the legislature, two types of elections, either partisan or nonpartisan, plus this nomination by commission with retention elections.
Michigan's system is that the election for state Supreme Court is nonpartisan. It's on the nonpartisan part of the ballot. If you look there, you do not see party affiliation. But in order to get on the ballot, generally you have to be nominated by one of the political parties. And I was thinking about that as you said that in these states, you don't know the party that the judge is affiliated with. In Michigan, it is not that hard to find out if you just want to see who nominated them to put them on the ballot. Just the ballot itself doesn't tell you that. How did Michigan end up with that system?
Yeah, Michigan has a very unique system. In fact, it's the only state in the country that has this system. And you explained it perfectly. It's a nonpartisan general election ballot where you see Judge Smith go against Judge Jones. But it turns out Judge Smith was nominated by the Republican Party during a political party convention in the state, and Judge Jones was nominated by the Democratic political party convention. Realize political party conventions are the most partisan types of institutions we can have. Nothing wrong with that. It's just a very partisan issue. There are only Democrats or only Republicans in their respective political party conventions. And so they're nominating the judges. And then all of a sudden, the judges are supposed to be nonpartisan in their election, in the general election, at least. In the last number of years, particularly with a lot of information being available and with campaign monies increasing, we know much more about these candidates. It used to be more difficult to figure this out, but it's pretty easy. to do this. And in fact, the political parties themselves have become more adept at this. When they put out their own campaign literature before an election, both the Democrats and the Republicans will include their judges that they nominated in the list of, please vote for all of these Democrats or all of these Republicans. And so it is much easier to find out who's a Democrat and who's a Republican at this point.
So over the years, there have been various calls for reforming how Michigan elects judges to the Michigan Supreme Court, often calling for some way in which perhaps the governor would appoint members and then be confirmed by the state Senate. What's the main argument that people will make that there should be an appointment system rather than having justices elected by the citizenry?
Well, they usually come down to normative types of arguments. Some people argue that the courts should be devoid of politics. There should not be influenced by politics in any way. So let's bring in some sort of system that takes politics out of the equation. Some people argue that nonpartisan elections will take that out of the equation. I think the practical reality is nonpartisan elections aren't all that different from partisan elections, so that doesn't seem to be the case. Some people argue that gubernatorial appointment of the justices will take politics out of the system, because this way you know that the governor is accountable, but the governor will appoint people who are the best judges. Some people say, well, no, governors won't do that. They're going to appoint either their buddies or their partisans. So that's why others have come up with this nomination by commission, and they'll call it the merit system, by saying that this takes this system, by having a commission come up with the names, and the governor is limited by the names on that list, and then we have a retention election. This way the people have a say, the governor has some say, the commission has some say, and it takes politics out of the system. There's actually a lot of evidence that while in theory that may be the case, the evidence is such that it doesn't work all that well. In other words, there's still politics in the system. For instance, who's on the who's on the commission? There's a lot of research that shows that when the governor is responsible for appointing the people on the commission, surprise, surprise, the people on the commission put people on the list that the governor wants to see, all right? And so there's a lot of politics that still goes on in those types of things. The other issue is in retention elections, very few justices who are up for retention lose their seats. A couple years ago in Iowa, there was a lot of turmoil because there were three justices on the Iowa Supreme Court who lost their seats after they had ruled in favor of same-sex marriage in the state of Iowa. And outside groups came in and they pummeled those justices in a retention election, and all three of them lost. And everyone, particularly people who were looking at nomination by commission and retention elections, were up in arms and saying, hey, this is not the way it's supposed to go. But of course, in many ways it was. I mean, if a retention election is about accountability and the people vote one way or another, and if people in Iowa said, this is not the way we want to go, that's not a problem in that sense. Although some said that really retention elections are more like impeachment as opposed to we don't like the politics of those types of decisions. Nonetheless, what's going on here is we have politics in these systems. And the other part of it is Iowa was a complete aberration. In the last 50 years, very few, there's only been maybe five or six justices across the country who have lost retention elections. Retention elections, they're retained over and over and over again. And that's even been in Iowa and other states where these groups have tried to unseat judges in particular who have voted in favor of same-sex marriages, and they've lost anyway. The votes are close, but generally speaking, they've lost. So again, there's politics in all of these systems, and that's one reason why, from my perspective, I believe some of the scholarship that shows that judicial elections are actually some of the best ways to select Supreme Court justices. As one scholar said, and I'm quoting here from a book, judicial elections are democracy-enhancing institutions that operate efficaciously to serve to create a valuable nexus between citizens and the bench. In other words, justices serve, decide important issues of policy, and they should be held accountable by the people. We may not agree with the decisions that they make, or we may not agree with the decisions that our electorate makes when they come in, but there's actually a lot of evidence that shows that judicial elections are efficient ways of dealing with policy issues within the states. I'm not saying that we should change the system in the federal government where the president appoints and the Senate changes. The U.S. Supreme Court's a little bit different, but at the state level, where Supreme Court justices are making very important decisions on policy, I don't have as much of a problem with elections.
To play devil's advocate, some people will wonder, when you get to that point in the ballot, how informed are voters about those candidates for state Supreme Court, as opposed to things higher up, like governor and United States Senate. When you get to that point on the ballot, do people really have a good grasp of who the candidates are, what they stand for, and some of the things that you generally use to determine who you're going to cast a vote for?
Actually, there's more information than you than most people believe. And the more partisan the elections are, the more information there is out there. So, for instance, we know that there's something known as ballot roll-off. That's where people vote at the top of the ballot and then stop voting as they get down below. There's much less ballot roll-off when there are partisan elections for justices than there is when there are either retention elections or nonpartisan elections. So, and there's actually evidence that shows that the electorate has more information about voters than oftentimes we give the voters credit for. Now, sometimes the ads are kind of silly. There's no question about that. We saw that in the last electoral campaign. But the fact is, voters actually, they exercise their franchise generally in a way that is not necessarily as ignorant as many people think they are.
So when you mentioned the idea of partisan judicial elections, is there an argument to be made then we should just put the R's and the D's by the candidates' names on the ballot in Michigan, the Libertarians and the Green Parties as well? Let everyone know who nominated these people. Of course, you can find out in other ways, but if it's on the ballot, perhaps it's a little more cut and dried. You could count those votes if someone votes a straight party ticket. I mean, is there an argument to be made that we would just be better off if we removed that curtain and say, here are the candidates, here's what party they're affiliated with?
I believe so. I do. I mean, if we're going to have the parties nominate the candidates, why don't we know whether Smith and Jones are Republicans and Democrats or other third party or minor party candidates? I don't have a problem with that. The most important cue that voters use when they're in the ballot box is the partisan cue. You know, in other words, they know if someone's a Democrat or Republican. And even though people say, oh, I don't want to be as partisan and things like that, the fact is we get a number of people, many people, who vote, you know, straight party lines. And the interesting thing is in Michigan, if you vote the straight party ticket for either Republican or Democrat, that will not include the Supreme Court justices because they're nonpartisan. So you actually have to go down there and vote separate for them. I think it actually would be more efficacious if we had partisan ballots. But again, there are people who make the argument that courts are different and they should not be partisan and they're dealing with issues of fairness and objectivity and there's no such thing as a Republican judge or a Democratic judge. There's evidence to show that partisanship does make a big difference on the courts. On the other hand, they're judges and they can be objective even when they're not. And that's where some of my research on the history of the Michigan Supreme Court came in because, you know, Michigan has this really interesting system where we it's kind of a hybrid system, right? We have a partisan slash nonpartisan system. If you don't know what they did in the party conventions, you'll just see Judge Smith and Judge Jones on the ballot. You won't know which they are. I don't have a problem with saying it that way. But interestingly, and this was research I found, and I want to give a plug to the Michigan Supreme Court Historical Society, which provided me with a grant to do this research. But Michigan's history is real interesting. When Michigan first became a state, we followed the federal system, where the governor appointed and the state senate, you know, gave confirmed those nominations, and that's how we came in the when Michigan became a state in the 1830s. That lasted up until 1850, through what seems to be a wave of Jacksonian democracy, where basically we changed everything to in the country to some sort of election, you know, from high offices all the way down to you know your smallest local local
drain commissioner,
well. Yeah, drain commissioner, you know, dog catcher, whatever it happens to be, exactly, you know. And in fact, the vast majority of states from the mid-1840s through mid-1850s changed to some sort of electoral system. And Michigan changed at that point to a partisan electoral system. That lasted until the early part of the 20th century, where in 1908, we particularly said we're going to use partisan elections. And there were some little minor changes that came in. But this was when the progressive era started. Many court reformers were coming in and saying, these partisan elections, bare-knuckled politics, they don't belong in judicial in the judicial institution. So there were a number of court reformers who tried to change Michigan's system. And particularly in the 1930s, these are groups like, for instance, the Michigan Bar Association, the American Bar Association, and other court reform groups tried to bring in this new system they were calling, well, they didn't even call it the merit system at the beginning, but it was a nomination by commission system. Actually, Michigan almost passed this before Missouri did. So it's an interesting thing. We call this the Missouri plan today. Had Michigan passed it a few years earlier, we might be calling it the Michigan plan today. But there were a number of failed attempts to bring in either nonpartisan elections or this nomination by commission in Michigan in the 1930s. They failed, and in 1939, we passed a constitutional amendment that brought in the current system that we have. And that's the nonpartisan general election, but the party conventions choose and nominate the candidate.
So how come it failed then, and how come there have been various calls since then which have never really amounted to a serious challenge to what we currently do in Michigan?
Well, that's the interesting thing. Ever since we came up with this system where this, you know, so-called merit system failed, and we now have our current hybrid system of partisan, nonpartisan elections, again, the Michigan Bar, American Bar Association, and other groups have tried to bring in this system of nomination by commission and retention elections. They did it in 1944 and they failed, and in 1950 and 52 and they failed. And then in the 1970s, there were a number of proposals that were failed. A big chance to bring about change was during the Constitutional Convention in the early 1960s. There was a lot of talk and there were proposals to change the Michigan system to something different. They all failed, every single one. Even there, they failed. And there's been a new judicial task force in Michigan that's been going on in the last few years. There are both former Michigan Supreme Court justices and federal court justices who are from the left and the right ideologically, along with former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who have really tried to push Michigan's system into some sort of nomination by commission, or at least get rid of this partisan, nonpartisan system that we have, and it keeps failing. Right. And so the question is, why does it fail? Well, part of it's institutional inertia. Sometimes once we have something particularly set in the Constitution, it's difficult to change. Okay, we don't change too much. And if it didn't change when we changed the entire Constitution during what's colloquially known as ConCon in the early 1960s, it's pretty difficult to change. And it's been, you know, 50 some years since that time.
And an individual constitutional amendment requires either a lot of petition signatures with a lot of money backing it, or a supermajority of the legislature putting it on the ballot, and then a vote statewide.
That's right. And those two issues are precisely why we're not going to change the system anytime soon. Because to get a constitutional amendment for an individual issue like this, you need the support of, like I said, a supermajority of the legislature and a majority of the people. So that's telling politicians, you have to give up your power in these political party conventions to nominate the judges. And then it's telling the people, you have to give up your franchise to vote. And it doesn't win. Simple as that. I mean, there are a number of people who agree with the bar associations that we should move on to get away from elections. These are nasty types of institutions. And so let's not elect judges. We shouldn't be electing judges the same way we elect legislatures. And there's always a solid, you know, minority of people who agree with that. But the majority say we don't want to give up the vote. And again, the politicians don't want to give up the power either. So I don't see any change on the horizon that's actually going to happen unless there's something really big that kind of sparks it, but I don't see that coming up anytime soon.
Mark Hurwitz, thank you for your time.
Pleasure, Gordon. Thank you.
More of our discussion with Western Michigan University political science professor Mark Hurwitz can be heard at WMUK.org, including the role of so-called dark money in judicial elections.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Diane Randall is executive secretary of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She lobbies for peace and social justice issues and is described as a voice for Quaker advocacy. She will speak this Saturday at the Kalamazoo Friends Meeting. Her address is called Keeping Faith in Congress, Building Peace at Home and Abroad. Diane Randall, thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So we're told that your appearance in Kalamazoo is going to ask what role can people of faith fulfill in shared security? Let's begin by defining our terms here. What do you mean by shared security?
What we mean by shared security is an approach toward foreign policy that looks at a more ethical and effective way for the United States to act in the world. And so what our hope is that we can begin turning away from a militarized foreign policy and toward a policy that is based on peace-building principles. And so I'll be talking a little bit about what some of those principles are, some of the approaches are that certainly we are doing some of that as a country, but we believe there's much more that we could do.
And explain the role of faith in that, especially the Quaker faith.
Sure. Well, thanks for that question. So Quakers are known as a historic peace church, and certainly there are many, many Quakers, although not every Quaker, who are pacifists. And historically, Quakers have opposed war in many ways, both personally as conscientious objectors, but also in our advocacy and our engagement. And so as Friends, as with the Religious Society of Friends is what Quakers' formal title is, we believe that it is very important to act from those core beliefs. And the core beliefs, of course, stem from the Christian gospel of loving one another and practicing the golden rule. So that's really the basis of a lot of our opposition to war and our practicing of and promoting of peace. However, I will say that I think that there's a very robust climate here in Washington, D.C. for voices of people of faith. Our Congress looks, I think, at moral questions, and those who look at politics through a moral lens often have something to offer. And so our organization, the Friends Committee on National Legislation, does a lot of work with other faith-based organizations that on issues of peace or on issues of domestic policy, immigration reform, a whole range of public policy concerns that many people of faith share.
I should note we are speaking on Tuesday afternoon. This is the day that the Senate Intelligence Committee is releasing a report on the CIA's use of torture. So as we talk, some of the details are still leaking out, becoming known. In general, is it helpful that there is a report out there and that there is an opportunity to examine the practices that were used, especially after September 11th of 2001?
We believe that it's incredibly important for this report to be released and for us to begin to look at the practices that our own government used to try to secure information and to try to respond to what was indeed a strong and overreaction, we believe, to the violence that happened against our country on 9/11. That terrible event, day of events, really has caused a whole change of the way that our country responds to and our understanding of what we think is necessary for national security. I think the torture report is probably one of the, exemplifies some of the most egregious behavior that I don't think anyone really, well, there might be a small minority of people who still are trying to justify it, but for the most part, I think the American public finds this practice absolutely abhorrent. And I say that as a person of faith, but I think it is, goes way beyond whether people are religious or spiritual in any way. This is just a violation of human dignity and a violation of human rights. And it's important that we begin to take a look at it because we should never be practicing that, not as a country that is believes in democracy and believes in the things that we believe in as United States citizens. It is important to name these and to tell the truth.
The Friends Committee on National Legislation website calls for action on the issue of police shootings and the militarization of police forces. As someone who's up there on Capitol Hill often, what are the things that you would want Congress to do in particular? Since we're often talking about local police departments, what's the role for Congress here in trying to address the issue of police tactics as well as perhaps the police equipment that they get from the federal government?
So you're turning now to a different form of militarization, which concerns us greatly. I mean, we've been talking earlier about militarization of our foreign policy, but in fact, the militarization of our domestic policy is also disconcerting to us. And where we've seen it most recently, of course, is in Ferguson, in New York City, really what people are calling over-policing. But part of that, we believe, is also almost incentivized by a program out of the Pentagon called the 1033 program. That's a program that gives away unused or old military gear and equipment to local police forces. So you see some examples of not only municipal police forces, but campus polices and police forces having access to this kind of equipment that goes way beyond what anyone would expect to be used in a neighborhood or in a small town or even in a large city. And I think it has actually also contributed to the idea that police are less community-based and more almost paramilitary in some cases. And so we're seeking to have that program repealed. We've been working with Representative Hank Johnson out of Georgia and have been seeking co-sponsors for a bill to try to repeal the 1033 program. It's raised a lot of questions, not only about that program at the Pentagon, but also about other programs run by the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Justice with regard to how local police forces have access to this kind of equipment and gear and actually practice using techniques on local citizens in ways that, again, I think we're seeing such a strong reaction to over-policing that we're hopeful that we'll see some action on this when the new Congress comes in January.
You co-wrote an op-ed for The Hill back in February about election reform. And I guess I'm wondering if the Supreme Court decisions on campaign finance, including Citizens United, have made it more difficult for an organization like yours to get their foot in the door in Washington, or at least get their message heard?
It's a great question. You know, there's no, you know, I think that one of the frustrations that a lot of people around the country have with Washington, D.C. is that really disproportionate amount of money that is flowing into campaigns and the sense that politicians and elected officials, after they've gone through a political campaign, are going to be in the pocket, so to speak, of those who've donated to them. So we do have a concern, obviously, about that kind of money in campaigns because it is a question of access and who has access to the elected officials. Our representatives and senators are elected to represent all the people, not just the people who've been able to fund their campaigns. And so we have begun looking at this, have begun convening a group, again, of faith organizations to try to take a look at what could be done about trying to reduce the effect of money in politics and try to reform, trying to get Congress to take back decision-making about what kind of money can go into political campaigns. In terms of how it affects us, you know, we have a voice. FCNL, Friends Committee on National Legislation, my organization, has been lobbying in Washington for over 70 years. We were the first faith-based lobby here. And so we have a voice and a reputation that is known here. Again, not everyone agrees with us, but members of Congress know where we stand and often seek out a perspective that we have to offer. So that's important in terms of the people we have working here who are going into offices day in, day out on the Hill. But the other thing we have to offer is really a vibrant network of people across the country, including folks in Kalamazoo and throughout Michigan, who care about these issues and who share our concern about the issues and who are willing to talk to their members of Congress. And that, to me, is one of the most powerful things that we and other citizen-based organizations have that many corporate interests and many moneyed interests don't share, is this sort of widespread network of citizens who are willing to be engaged in talking to members of Congress about what they believe should be done to make better policies both domestically and internationally.
As someone who is out there trying to encourage people to be engaged in public policy, engaged in the issues, when you combine the large amounts of money that people see going into the process, combined with a very low approval rating for Congress as an institution, is it difficult to get that message across to people that engagement, involvement is important and that it's worth their time?
It is difficult sometimes to get that message across because people feel often that their elected officials are quite removed from them. But those folks who have been involved in the process or who have some other kind of connection to the elected officials, perhaps they've known them when they were the mayors or when they were a state rep. And also people who actually have the experience of going into an office and talking to a member of Congress or talking to their staff often see this differently because they realize that whether or not the member of Congress agrees with the person who's lobbying, they inevitably will be received well. I mean, it's very rare that we have folks going into offices and there's any kind of coldness or hostility. Most members of Congress are willing and anxious to know how their constituents feel on particular issues. And so we think it's critically important for people to make phone calls into offices, to convene with other like-minded folks and pay visits both at the district level, but also come to Washington and go visit. I mean, these offices are set up to interact with constituents, and certainly the district offices are made to do that. And I think it's really, really important that we, as citizens of this country and as people who have we are blessed to have the kind of representative democracy that we have, and we should be exercising it, not only at the voting booth when it's our opportunity to vote for our members of Congress or for our state legislature, but also to follow up and to stay on our elected officials. They're working for us, and they need to hear from us.
Diane Randall, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Gordon.
Diane Randall is Executive Secretary of the Friends Committee on National Legislation. She will speak this Saturday at the Kalamazoo Friends Meeting.
Details of Diane Randall's visit to Kalamazoo and a longer version of this interview can be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.